Are you ready? Everyone hear the announcement about no meeting in 2 weeks? And then our last meeting will be courtesy of Nancy's hospitality at her house. And we'll meet earlier. We'll meet, I think it's June 1st, 12 to 1:30. I will present, we'll have a regular class, but a short one. And about the last 10 minutes or 15 minutes, I'll just show you a video clip of the introduction to the play Copenhagen. Really not about Pali, but it's about this era, and it talks about Bohr and Heisenberg, so just kind of give you a feeling for what we're working with. I guess Linda said that Pulitzer Prize just went to the biography of Oppenheimer.
For history.
And then it's Noah Hassel potluck, just cold stuff from 12:30 to 1:30. We can just talk. And it's on me. There's no charge for that one. Just say thanks for hanging in there with this difficult material.
So is that June 1st?
June 1st, yeah. So there's no meeting in 2 weeks. I have to be out of town. And then final meeting, short meeting, and then potluck at Nancy's.
And I'll provide the drinks.
Yep, that actually happened once. We had a potluck. We said, don't plan it. Everyone brought dessert. So we were chit-chattering going very fast. I might suggest things like cold cuts or tuna salad or chicken salad or bread or cheese or something that's easy to just... Okay, let's do a review. Can we have one person bring a dessert and the rest be a potluck? Who wants to bring a dessert?
I could bring a dessert.
Okay, Carol, bring a dessert. Everyone else can bring something.
5801 Central Avenue. The northeast corner of 58 and Central. Don't throw it in here.
Great, thank you too, Nancy. Quick review. Dream 13, which was, I've forgotten the page. Let's see. Page 50. Just a sort of background for the dream, and we'll be moving into this, and I think you're going to see it gets a little more human as we get into the material, because Pali's about to fall in love. And the background, I don't know exactly how they originally met. I'm thinking probably at the Jung Institute, which was founded in 1948. Or maybe, Jung had that psychological club where people would come together, I think once a week, and give lectures, and Pali would have lectured there too. So he and von Franz knew each other. But I don't think there was a real much of a contact until the end of 1950. She sent him a manuscript, and they began talking. And then we'll follow how that developed. But this dream occurred the end of 1949. So it's just a year before their relationship picked up. So our author doesn't say so, but my thought was that's what the fire refers to. That we're going to see Pali was, as we worked on now, given through his dreams this assignment to talk about the stranger publicly, and we'll be talking more about what that means today. Pali was literally to begin lecturing and publicly addressing the things we are talking about, and that pressure came from the unconscious, as far as I understand it, and as far as our author is working with it. And then what came along, as it often does, is a relationship that was appropriate to just that task. And that relationship was von Franz. And Dave, the guy who wrote the biography, on Pally Young, Meeting of Two Great Minds, you know, dug around all these archives and met a bunch of Pally's friends. And he was told by one of the guys who was Pally's friends that they had he and his wife, Pally and his wife, had a friendship, but he didn't think it was a real relationship of passion. So there was all of Pally's libido probably running around free, and then here comes Von Franz. I think she was 34 when they met. With this crackerjack mind, and both an incredible capacity for emotional honesty, I can tell you that personally, and also this fantastic mind who could follow him. And he probably never met anyone like that. Probably wasn't anyone else like that in the world that could have met him both emotionally and intellectually. So then we'll be following how that evolved, how his dreams pick up on that relationship, and how the dreams then emphasize the themes that we've been talking about in the context of that relationship. So it's all going to blend together. So the dream on the October 49, 1949, he has a fire in a second story room where a departmental conference on mathematics is being held, and he then is forced down. Well, you don't have to have a PhD in symbolism to see what that was about. That some fire, now it doesn't say it's about eroticism, but that's my guess, that some fire is going to start in his life and it's going to bring him to start dealing with the reality dimension of what we've been talking about. We've been talking about the unity of matter and spirit as it applies to science. But he's also going to realize that it applies to his personal life and that he can't deal with one without the other. So that's my sense. He then mentions at the end of the dream that he figures it was the stranger, remember the stranger, who started the fire, which would mean that, here I think you see the teleology of the unconscious, that there's a task to be done, and that whatever it is that is symbolizing that task, whatever it is that's behind that task, arranges events in life. In this case, his relationship to Von Franz, or arranges the emotions which events in life coincidentally seem to coincide with. That's the main one there. The dream on the dream 14 on the bottom of 51 was pretty much the same thing. Fire over water, remember. Fire bringing down to reflection. Water there meaning reflection in the Chinese discussion of it. We got into a huge discussion about the lower trinity. I just wanted to make sure everyone understands that. Because remember the dream where the stranger appeared out of the river after going into the river? There were three sticks on the ground. Then the author quotes a letter of Pally's to Emma Jung where he relates the three sticks, to make it very short, to the lower trinity. What's the lower trinity? Who wants to try it? It's so important here.
It's the feminine, rather than the masculine.
It's, yeah, right.
And you said it was three witches.
Could be.
It could be. And you said, you said something about Macbeth, that it was the three muses, I guess, in Macbeth.
Well, they're witches in Macbeth.
The witches?
Yeah.
Okay, and did they stand for any particular, each one stand for something? That was my question.
Well, they're just the ones that told him what was going to happen in his life.
Okay.
So they had foreknowledge. Remember when, what's it, something wood goes to something else? It's been a while since I studied that. Do you remember that? How does that go? When Dunsen wood comes to, some woods comes to someplace else. And the witches say to him, you know, beware of this danger. And it's a nonsensical message. It's like when some forest, basically, it's when the forest comes to the castle, watch out. And then as it turns out, the people who are going to overthrow him cut down the trees, hide behind them, and literally move the forest to begin their assault on Macbeth. So the three witches there knew what the story is going to be of his life. So the idea of foreknowledge, you see, is always there.
Okay.
With the Trinity and the lower Trinity, both.
And then the one is the self, right?
And the?
The self is one, and the three is the witches, or it can be that.
Well, the problem is everything's everything.
Okay.
Depending on how you look at it, I'm trying to keep this simple. Let's start with the upper Trinity. The upper Trinity would be what we have defined basically as the Spirit. You know, that factor which engenders and orders, that moves life forward.
Are you differentiating it from the Spirit and matter then?
And then the Trinity is when the lower Trinity is when that Spirit works through matter. The upper Trinity is when it works through imagination and conscious experience and dreams and ecstasy. The lower Trinity is when it works through matter, depression, physiology. Does that make sense?
Yeah, could that be, because we in the other class had something, could that be body, soul, and spirit?
I would say it would be the spirit in the body, the spirit in matter.
Mm-hmm.
That's the lower Trinity.
But for the three, I mean, you don't need anything but just the three witches for the number three.
Right.
The higher Trinity has each one, and three has a name.
Oh, I see what you mean. That's right. It's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, Mary, but they generally are not distinguished. 1, 2, 3 in the lower Trinity like they are in the upper Trinity.
Okay.
And that may be a good way to segue into this complicated, it's complicated to the logical mind, but it's not complicated to the symbolic mind, that those three below are the missing fourth above. So that 1 equals 3.
And the lower is Sophia.
And the lower is exactly what we talked about as Sophia.
Okay.
Now, see, why this is so important for Pauli is we're going to be seeing his physical desire for Von Franz as meaningful. There's a spirit in that. His psyche is bringing him into contact with the person who can help him move his work forward. That's where the spirit is operating in him, in his desirousness, in his bodily desirousness. And the reason Jung makes such a big deal of it, I think, is we're so used to thinking of the spirit as this saving experience. When in fact, when it appears in the lower Trinity, even though it is a saving experience, it feels like a damning experience. That's the great problem. And we're so ready to throw it out because it appears so unsanitary. There again, the unconscious, I think, was pressing Pauli to an adulterous relationship. And he didn't. He ran. Why? Because he looked at life through the point of view of the upper Trinity, who will only accept guidance when it's spick and span. And of course, you know, just I'm sure you know this, but if you're ever talking about this in public, you will certainly get attacked with, well, are you just granting license to any Don Juan that exists? No, because you can see when this stuff happens that there's a higher demand being placed on the person, and that demand is felt to be so cumbersome that mitigates them just getting into this for fun. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
Probably just wasn't being asked to do some dirty things at night, he was asked to begin reshaping the face of science. That was the real task, and that was the burden. And then, as an aid, this other experience with von Franz comes into play. But it's not vice versa.
Seems like he was also being asked to have a real relationship as
yeah.
opposed to what he had had before,
right.
which he had done plenty of times,
yeah.
according to this.
Right.
But, and he couldn't.
He couldn't do it.
He would have to
yeah.
do it from a different, totally different place.
Yeah.
And with an equal.
And with an equal, an absolute equal, that's probably even a better, if I may say. I mean, I'm sure she was utterly his equal intellectually. And that woman could just speak, and you felt like you got hit in the chest with a bowling ball. She just had a way of getting through to people emotionally. So that was probably both of what she was to represent for him. If you get upset with Pauli, I would ask you not to let it affect your feeling about this material. Why? Because I think what we're seeing in Pauli is the collective unconscious communicating a new point of view to us. It just happened to have picked him. But the idea, which maybe I've said or maybe I haven't said, so let me repeat it, is that there is a new point of view already inside us. The solution to the problems that we've been talking about is already there. It's not that we have to create it. We just have to transmit it. So you can, I think you can look past the Pauli's foibles, and what we can get out of this for our own benefit is what is the nature of that point of view that's being communicated first to Pauli, now to us, irregardless of whether he could hear it or not. That to me is why I feel it's worth sticking with the material, even though he himself becomes pretty frustrating to deal with. And I'm sure that's why Jung and von Franz stuck with him also. Why did it choose him as one of its early messengers? Well, there's that, perhaps I should have run along, there's that beautiful quote in the Vision Seminar, in the Zarathustra Seminar, when somebody said to Jung, well, do most people deal with these kind of issues in their dreams that we're dealing with in this book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra? And Jung said, no. Because most people are only concerned about their own piddly little lives. But Nietzsche was a man who was deeply concerned about the evolution of history and culture, and that's why these things came to him. The depth of the material is reflective of the depth of the questions that are being asked. And Pauli, through his heartache after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was at least trying to ask these questions. So I think that's why it came to him. But the basic idea now is going to be, what is the nature of how we are being invited to change the way we look at life, both in science, in psychology, and religion? And then, a little bit more interesting, how is this personal relationship going to play into that? And that itself becomes a very fascinating narrative. Which takes us up to Dream 50. On page 54, which is where we stop. Does this make sense to everybody? I'm trying to put it in a wider perspective so that when you are going through these dreams, you kind of have a feeling for why we're doing this stuff.
Could you just make that last statement, how this is affecting us or something?
Yeah, there is a whole new point of view down there about how science, what the new scientific worldview should be, how we are to understand our religious life, that there is in fact no conflict between the two. In other words, the new paradigm, which will be hundreds of years in evolution, this is his hypothesis at least, is already there in us in the form of dream images. Or these dream images are symbolizing the answers to all these questions that we put. why has science become so destructive? Why has religion become so effete? Why is it that we live in this split world between spirit and matter? And all that, according to him, is what the stranger personifies. So the stranger is the knowledge in the unconscious of that new worldview, which is slowly now attempting to be born. Why so long? Well, if you think of how science, for example, or religion, has evolved, it goes in big chunks, in hundreds of year chunks. And I think we are in the position, say, of a medieval alchemist who couldn't understand quantum physics, to be where we, our current level of consciousness is not in a position to understand the new paradigm yet. But we're looking at it here in a huge cultural evolution, but not to be intimidated, because it occurs in small steps. And our job is to do the small step as best we can, and then pass it on to the next generation. Let them pick it up. I think, you remember the dream I had about when I started doing this, about the road between spirit and matter? Mm-hmm. How I got into this was I had a dream that I was part of a construction crew, and we were walking toward a construction site, and the crew that was working on it was tired, and they were done with their work. They had surveyed the road, I think, they had leveled it, and they had graded it with stones, and my crew was coming on to finish that job. And as we were walking towards the construction site, the foreman came up from the crew. It was, you know, maybe a half mile ahead. I could kind of see the dust. Foreman came up. We were talking. He was kind of telling me what we should do. And I said to him, "Oh, by the way, where does this road go?" And he said, "Between matter and spirit." So what I took out of this is not only just the subject matter, but that Jung's generation did their work, and they passed it on to us, and now we have to do our work, and we'll pass it on to the next generation. So even though the task is huge, it doesn't mean we should give up or feel that it's silly because it's so big and we're so small, because that's the way it's going to go from generation to generation. Okay, next stream, 54, I think I'll just summarize. We got into it, and then we'll come back to it and continue. There's a wooded landscape, and he sees there's a ravine below. And apparently up where he is, experiments are being conducted with rays and electrical currents. He is suspicious that there's an electrical cable that's coming up from the ravine that is powering this experiment. And he's suspicious that there's something wrong about that cable. So he starts to descend down into the ravine to check things out, and his figure is illuminated by lights. And he's afraid then that his suspicion is confirmed, and that the people who are supplying the current down below are really criminals. And then the stranger comes. Now remember, the stranger is going to be a constant figure now. He later becomes the master. He was first the blonde and the Persian, and he became the stranger. He will eventually become the master, but he'll be the stranger for quite a while. The stranger would represent the knowledge of the unity between matter and spirit, both as it will reflect in a new scientific paradigm, as it will reflect in a new understanding of religion, and as it will reflect in Pauli getting just the personal, fleshy relationship he needs when his spirit wants him to begin working creatively. So the stranger comes on and cuts the bad cable. And then Pauli realizes there is a genuine cable that exists alongside the false one. And the criminals at that point disappear. Then the stranger says, "I have something to show you," and shows Pauli a set of scales. The scales have two pieces of wood on them that are parallel, I think, if I remember. And check that. They're parallel. If you want to look at Roman numeral or letter B back at the end of your study guide, and the scale is uneven. The stranger says, you think there's an unequal weight here, but really there isn't. And he turns one of the pieces of wood 90 degrees. So they're perpendicular. And the scale balances. So that's the dream. Well, what we worked on so far was von Franz interprets the, because here now, see, they're corresponding. We are now where? October 1950. See, so now they're in contact. Von Franz interpreted that dream to suggest that the criminals were the source of blinding projections. Another reason, she says blinding, I think, is because of the nature of that light. It blinded Pauli when it shone on him. And she relates that to the Trinitarian frame of mind. So, what is the Trinitarian frame of mind?
All light.
All light, yes. It's all light, and it doesn't doubt itself. If you remember in Number and Time, those of you who did Number and Time, we talked about the symbolism of 1, 2, 3, and 4. 1 would represent a unity of a of an unconscious state of mind, which gets cut up into 2, meaning that there is often behind an unconscious condition an unconscious conflict. And as we become aware of what lies behind our unconsciousness, the 1, we find the 2, which is the conflict. And it's funny how this creeps in the dreams. I just saw a dream yesterday of a woman in such a situation, and she had to cut up a pizza. See, it's the 1. And then it has to be cut to see the conflict underneath. Then Jung's idea, big idea, is that if you endure the tension, the 3rd emerges, which resolves that conflict. And that's the creative aspect of the unconscious. It creates the synthesis of the 2. The problem with that state of mind is, like a reformed smoker, you are pretty dogmatic about this new truth you just got. That's why Trinitarian and light and self-righteous all go together. It is a hard-won insight very often, which you happen to think applies to everyone else because it applies to you. So the step to open-mindedness would be going to the 4th. And the 4th would be when you realize you have your truth, which has to be examined from the point of view of other people as well. So the Trinitarian state of mind would be Pauli's being convinced that he's right about everything. Well, we can understand maybe why that is, because we've seen how he had to pull himself up by the bootstraps, by his bootstraps, in that work, you know, in the 30s, because he was so close to disintegrating in a dissolute life, brothels and booze. But the problem with that stability is people don't question themselves. And they don't listen to the point of view of other people either.
You mean stability 4?
3.
3, okay.
Yeah, when you finally resolve the chaos in yourself through the guidance of the unconscious, you have moved ahead in a way that you've gained stability, and you have gained a real piece of your individuality. But you just happen to think it's everybody else's individuality.
So then, can you keep, how do you go from 3 to 4?
Well, of course. Well, that's what those 40 volumes are about.
Okay. I bring that up because I know that in alchemy, isn't that the mantra?
Yeah, that's why he went to alchemy. He finished the work on the Trinity with volume 5. When I say the Trinity, I mean the Trinitarian. But volume 5 is about developing ego strength. It's about the Trinitarian attitude. It's about rescuing yourself from your chaos. And he did that by the time he was 38. Then the next 50 years, 48 years, he worked on how do you go from 3 to 4. That's alchemy.
And that's, you talked about that in volume 5.
In volume 5, it's about, volume 5 is the great Trinitarian book, you might say.
Okay.
What's the name of it?
A Symbol to Transformation. The Hero Myth. You know, I was just, we were talking about that French class when we started, but of course, we watched several French movies, and we got to talk about the difference between French and American movies, and it was pointed out, also a Tom Simeon article where the same thing was mentioned, that, you know, most American movies are about the hero myth. And the hero is good, he faces adversity, he's right, and he wins. That's all Trinitarian. When you look at European movies, it is highly ambiguous who's right and who's wrong. You don't know what the outcome is ultimately going to be. They bring in the ambiguity of life for our cinema, not our best cinema, but our average cinema, is dealing with right, strength, get it done. That's alternatarian. That shows you where we are as a culture. It's kind of pathetic. Pardon?
So that's the Bible.
That's the Bible, too. Yeah, certainly the Old Testament. So she is saying to Pauli, you are, your experiment in life has been funded by the blinding projections which are typical of a Trinitarian lifestyle. Why blinding projections in Trinitarian lifestyle? Because you are so fixed on being right that all that is wrong has to be projected and somebody else has to be wrong. You know, if you think about, you know, nations are never get beyond 3. Every major nation always needs to have somebody who's wrong.
That's how you get the forces together. You think the enemy is the devil.
Right. That's what the Trinitarian mind does. That is not what the Quaternarian mind does. Quaternarian mind knows it has a truth, but knows that truth is relative. So that's how this Trinitarian stuff would apply to Pauli personally, as well as in a more general sense, the move to science is moving toward the unity of spirit matter, which also breaks down that Trinitarian thing. So we're taking it on both poles.
Thinking how demonized John Kerry was for changing his mind, or anybody who changed his mind, you know, today.
Which is actually a sign of maturity.
Yeah.
You process facts, you realize you're wrong, and you say so.
And you say so.
Mm-hmm. It is scary when you take what I've just said and apply it to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You see how low our level of understanding is. And then Pauli being pushed toward that personally, and also then the shift from 3 to 4 would be the shift away from the split between spirit and matter.
Mm-hmm.
toward the unity of spirit matter. So that's its personal meaning and its scientific meaning. And of course, religiously, it would be the same thing, that we live in a Trinitarian religion, and the great challenge now is moved to a quaternarian one, which doesn't proselytize. Okay, that's where we left off. Von Franz interpreted the scales as in this vein of what we just said, that what really allows us to see things equally, you know, remember the scales at first were unequal, is that we turn our way of looking at things, and we look at things from many different points of view. And that's exactly what it is to shift to away from the Trinitarian standpoint. The Trinitarian standpoint never says, well, if I look at it from this angle, how does it seem? If I look at it from this angle, how does it seem? And no way, that's another way of saying you withdraw projections.
Your explanation is so beneficial, because I didn't get that out of it. I had a hard time with
that. Yeah. Really, I think I don't agree with him a lot of the times, but I think he did such a valuable work in at least putting up a point of view that we can then react to. And plus, he did an enormous amount of work just digging this. Most of these streams he dug up out of archives, you know, here and there. I mean, that would have, I can take it from here, but I could not have. I don't know German well enough to go find the letters, you know, and translate them from handwriting. So that's pretty much, I think, what the author says. On page 56, only by making them conscious does the true, deeper relationship to reality, which is not blinded by egocentric illusions, come into existence. That's the first paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines up.
Where did the projections come from?
That's the nature of the human being, that we go through a Trinitarian process which necessitates disowning part of ourselves and seeing it externally.
Seen the Trinity as older than Christianity.
That is true. That is true. You're right.
And that it was just a manifestation of Trinity in another.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
Trinity was created, wasn't it?
Here I'm not enough of a student of the history of religions, but I bet you can find Trinitarian arrangements of gods, you know, in the Sumerian.
I mean the Christian one. The Christians created their Trinity.
Yes, they did.
Well, they did and they didn't. It was already there. All they did was put a new name.
Well, they needed the Trinity.
They transformed it. Christian
right.
Exactly. The
Trinitarian
imagery
of the ancient. Yeah. All of
the world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this page also. So this other type of threeness was that kind of interest in that, you know, you have the four functions and that you use mostly three of them and push down the fourth. So there's kind of threeness there.
Same thing.
Border.
Because the three functions are conscious, if you're lucky, and they're all about keeping you afloat. they're related to the ego. It's the fourth function that is not related to your ego. It really doesn't care whether you stay afloat or not. But by the same token, it's the function you can use to look at the situation from other points of view.
It is the inferior function.
It's the inferior function.
That is most connected to the unconscious.
Yeah, so you could say moving from a Trinitarian to a non-Trinitarian point of view is making the inferior function conscious, and the inferior function is the capacity to look at things other than through your own eyes.
Because normally you think of kind of almost disowning your inferior function and think of it as not important.
Well, that's what the temptation, but
yeah.
In fact, I think that's such a misnomer. I think it just puts you off in the beginning to call it.
I agree.
Inferior.
Yeah,
function.
I don't know why he picked that.
Yeah.
I think it'd be much better to call it the creative function.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. Yeah. I'm having to relate it, and I won't take long, but to the Veil of Mysteries, when she actually has the experience with the god and goddess, comes back. Has the projection, thinks that her way, you know, she's seen the light. And
yeah.
and another woman stands behind her trying to say, hey, you know, that may be your experience, it's not my experience. And then the angel comes in and says, gal, you got to see the whole picture.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But it took that fourth function, which I'm saying is the creative function, to come in and say, you know, get back in your body, you're a human. This is how it's going to evolve.
I don't know why he picked that word. Mm-hmm. First of all, it doesn't mean it's weaker.
Right. It's just underdeveloped.
It's just underdeveloped. It can be much stronger than anything else you have in you. Mm-hmm. It's inferior only with respect to normative adaptation. Fitting into the normal world. And who cares anyway? And if you're an artist, you know, again, it's so unfortunate because your inferior function is really going to be where you live. And that's why life is so darn hard for these people, because they can't control this thing, but it's so strong and it's such a source of inspiration that they can't get rid of it.
I'm a little confused. Now, the artist's inferior function?
I would say that's where they create from.
Yeah.
And if they are enormously creative, if they're living in their creativity, then they're living in their inferior function. That is how they perceive of life through this lens, which is very good in a work of art, but very bad in reality. But the IRS and plumbers and electricians, they're all interested in how you function in time and space. So that's where these people keep banging their heads into reality.
Yeah, I've often observed how many great artists like Mozart have such messed up lives.
That's why. That's exactly why.
Don Thompson.
Their strength is not applicable to life. Okay. And yet, without their writing or their creation, they'd want to die. Yeah, definitely. And who is it who continually says to us, well, let's look at it from this point of view. See, that's the artist. That's the fourth. Okay.
I'm just a little confused in that if you call it an undeveloped function, then it seems like they're not living out of their undeveloped function, an artist. They're living out of their...
You're making sense. You're just forcing me to go into a subject. I wonder if anybody wants to go into.
No, well,
should we talk about it?
Sure.
Very briefly. I think it's important. Just wanted to check. I have to define my terms.
Okay.
The problem is understanding what does Jung mean by unconscious. He means not legislatable through decision. You can decide what you're going to do and then do it. You can just, a thinking type can decide to think and then think. A feeling type can decide to feel and then feel. An intuitive can decide to have a hunch and then hunch. What did I miss? Probably my main function. A sensation type can decide to, you know, I could decide to fix a bookcase and fix it. I had a friend in Switzerland who was living with a guy who was a raving intuitive. This guy was the karate champion of Zurich, of the canton of Zurich. And she said, he can't quit breakfast. Getting up, getting a pan, finding the butter, turning the stove on, that was just too much. See, that's the inferior function. It is not controllable through choice. But get that guy on a karate mat where his inferior sensation came out, and with the crowd cheering and the mood, he could be precise, lethally precise with his physical self, but he couldn't figure out how to cook a pancake. When he was in the mood to do his karate, then it could be done. And it could be done extremely well. But he was an intuitive. Now, he could tell you, just like that, stay away from that person. He just sniffed out who was who. Mm-hmm. Where myself, you ask, if I meet somebody, it takes me 3 or 4 days before I figure out. I have to wait until the intuition comes. So this is what he means by unconscious. And so my choice of words about develop was a little imprecise. I should have said, meant by developed, that you can control it. Like that, say that guy's, my friend's, karate guy's, his sensation was in a way better developed than mine in many areas. Physical, conditioning. Mm-hmm. But he just couldn't control it.
Are most artists intuitive, usually?
I don't think so, necessarily.
Don't think so.
Escher.
Really? Type a lot.
A lot. I would hate to generalize, though. So. I mean, I'd see Escher. Well, he's got to be a thinking type. He's got to be a thinking type, wouldn't you think? Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Remember that the function, whether it's conscious or not, means whether you can control it or not control it. It doesn't mean how sophisticatedly developed it is.
And Gary, does that development really deal more with the way we've adapted to our lives? Of the ones that aren't in the inferior function, they develop out of our adaptations to life, or are they just...
The superior or inferior?
The superior. Are they just who we are?
Well, the idea is you're born your type.
Okay.
And yes, a good upbringing would help, a parent would note, oh, this child is good with tools, we'll get them tools. This kid likes books, we'll give him books. This kid likes music, we'll get him a stereo. You know, a good parent will be watching what the kid's strength is, which is helping them develop their main function. Yeah.
Schools should do that.
Schools should do that too.
But they make sure that kids are all normal.
They make kids, yeah. Oh, I've had raving, feeling intuitives, artists, very, 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 very talented artists, tell me, you know, I was only allowed to do my art after I got 100 in my math test. So it was, everything was science, one person in particular. And that is often at the base of how, you know, a parental upbringing messes kids up. It's just the wrong type is emphasized.
And that was the parent at school.
That was the parent.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've gone, we're better today, don't you, than we were on that? But yeah, I mean, I remember my day. I remember in college being so told, you know, if you want to understand something, you have to be able to plan it out. I cannot learn by planning. And so, yeah. Yeah, Tom.
Come into relation with this creative function.
Yeah.
Is that where active imagination
can be? Yeah. Yeah. Then how? With the way you make conscious your main functions is you do work on choice and responsibility and so on. But the way you work with the main function is just like you get a dog, and you train it and it trains you. You have to learn to get along with it. And you don't tell it when it wants to go potty. It tells you when it wants to go potty. And that's so the work with the inferior function, you see, already dethrones the ego. Because I can say to my thinking, you know, now you get up and work on that. Class preparation. I cannot say that to my intuition. I have to wait until the intuition speaks to me. And then I have to listen to what it says. And I may not even agree with it, but I've learned the hard way to listen.
And find the courage to...
Follow it. Yeah. Well, I think I have an intuition about these like paragraphs here. The style of writing and the clarity of the exposition seems markedly different than anything else we've read before. Has this guy suddenly got a clue, or is this von Franz's work? Or he's talking about these four functions.
Oh.
I just mean from a stylistic and content.
I don't know, Tom.
Yeah, I did. That's right.
You felt that too?
Yeah.
It was
that funny.
More. It was much more forcefully stated and authoritatively stated and clearly stated. I thought it was a great exposition of the four functions, but nothing up to this.
Oh, you mean after the dream on the 30th?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I bet it's because it's linear.
Oh, so that you think the physicist didn't really like that because he could classify it in character.
Yeah.
I just thought it was really unusual. I just thought maybe that was von Franz coming through.
I think it's because it's linear. This is difficult material. I mean, this would be difficult for me. And this is all I do. And this guy is just writing a doctoral thesis. He probably had some therapy, but he's by no means trained.
Can we have one more question?
Yeah.
Creative function. Is this with us even in childhood?
Yeah.
We would see it?
Oh, yeah.
But do you think at midlife or whenever we go through transformation, does it become more active?
I think it does, as a matter of fact. Yeah, particularly if you do have a creative side, and you've been taught to be a good boy or girl, you know, you've effectively learned how to control that. Boy, it will not be controlled, and it comes barreling back. I think one thing we can offer kids is to help them develop in a whole way. There will be a crisis at midlife, but if there is some flexibility towards recognizing their other talents, which may not be other interests, which may not be useful educationally or professionally, then it's easier to begin working with it. And play really is the way this thing is developed. You have to play with it. That's why, you know, remember Jung playing with his bricks and stones? And you've got to give yourself permission, because so much of life is telling you not to play. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very important.
And doesn't all this TV and the games that the kids that's already
it scares
there,
me.
Yeah, I
it scares me.
Totally.
There is no imagination being developed anymore.
Yeah, I know.
It is scary.
Yeah.
Well, her son showed me something on the computer that I'd never seen before. I thought it was one of the most unique and creative things I'd ever seen, and it was one of those games they play, where they have to pick who they are and the armament they wear, and they create their personality. It's absolutely amazing, the whole world.
And I think Brooks talked to you, for 2 hours?
Yeah, I was just totally...
That sounds like Dungeons and Dragons.
It was like that.
Something else.
But it was the 3D.
Quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. I just wonder, you know, what they are developing through that.
I worry about it. Because, see, the imagery is given.
Mm-hmm. The imagery is given, but you choose what speaks to you, mm-hmm. and then you make lots of choices about where you go in this world and what you do in this world. So there's a lot of decision making.
Or a stand-in for it, it's hard. I would like to find hope in this generation, but so this might be something to be hopeful about. It worries me.
It blew me away to hear him talk about it and try it out and see it. It was amazing. I just kept saying to you what you were doing. So, Johnny, look at this. That. We're gone about the imagery and the symbols. I mean, it's totally blew me away.
I just wonder if children are so hungry for those things. For the symbolic, that this is, well, that's for sure. It's a, you know, a religion.
Yeah. Now, what's the long-term effect? That's the question.
Right.
I don't know.
And is it possible that people who are trained in active imagination are being recruited to help design these games?
I think it's a whole new area to look through our union frame of reference.
Well, it sounds so much like Dungeons and Dragons.
It is.
Which the kids, my kids all played it, mm-hmm. and it was against religion, it was against everything. It was not a terrible.
But it's the symbolism that I was talking about. I don't know.
Yeah, what it is all symbolism.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I've heard about it.
That's why it's dangerous.
Against religion.
I don't know.
That would be nice. There could be a positive side to all this, that in a way it is stimulating imagination. I just don't know. But it's certainly something that I pay attention to. That takes us over to 57. You're happy with the type stuff? The four keys would just mean, see, that's the shift from Trinitarian to the four.
Just one other point I wanted to ask you about. The top of 56, he says the two pieces are spatially separated, but sympathetically connected with each other. Is he drawing a parallel there to entanglement?
Yeah, to what we call participatio mystique.
I mean, in the idea in physics.
Same idea. That would be the idea in physics, taken as a metaphor.
Carol,
would you talk about that relationship in physics a little? Can you explain what you're talking about?
Well, as best as I can remember, entanglement in physics is that two photons that are emitted at the same time are sympathetically in contact with one another somehow, and that's what they call entanglement. And if they are separated by great distances, if you affect one with a laser so that its polarity changes, the polarity of the other photon will also change. So somehow they're entangled. That's the entanglement idea, that somehow they're connected, although they don't understand how.
And the other weird thing is that register of one to the other happens instantaneously, which defies the speed of light.
Yes.
What I find so interesting about that is that they would choose the word entanglement, because that carries a negative connotation when you think of things being entangled, like they can't, rather than using a word like soluble.
I suppose it is negative to the physicists, because they don't like to have those unknowns, those ghosts in their machine hanging around.
Exactly, but that's what I'm saying. I think that's really fascinating, and yet that seems to be what's beginning to emerge. And a different language would put it in a whole different way of viewing it.
And one of the positive ways some are viewing it are seeing it like a hologram. Mm-hmm. Seeing the two come through as being one, but being seen as separate, and the laser hits it. It comes on again. The whole one.
Certainly might be a good model for synchronous.
It definitely, where they're thinking, what is going on here?
Yeah, we had talked about that a number of times, the idea of entanglement and synchronicity. But here he doesn't, he seems to be connecting it more with projection.
Yeah, he's taking it as a metaphor that in the projected state, you are identical with the other person. But you don't know it.
And
that's dispositive mystique. In other words, same thing, yeah.
And for the artist, isn't that, you think that's something that they want?
Yeah, then they're crucified.
Right, I know, but I mean, that's a whole other conversation.
And that's a whole other conversation. Yeah, I mean, I think with the artist, you have to be able to move between the two realms if you're working with them. Let that participatio mystique phase be, and then when the time is right, go back and look at it.
Now, ultimately, you can consider a scientist as an artist.
Oh, absolutely, sure.
So in some sense, Pauli was an artist.
Absolutely.
So that...
Couldn't agree more.
You have to have their intuitive jobs to be scientists.
Absolutely.
And mystics have claimed that for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, we will be getting there. Pauli felt that the source of scientific discovery was the unconscious, just like an artist. And he thought that before a scientist got a theory, that theory appeared in images. So that science was really a revelation. Scientists think that they are rationally working it out, but his point of view was that's all being orchestrated from within. And he then worked with some of his own dreams, and we'll look at some of those dreams.
Would that be parallel to mathematics?
Same in mathematics. Yeah. Okay, let's have a stretch, and then we'll come back with a stranger.